Watch your step once more. You are in the minefield. It's wonderful to have your company here as we do our best to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Or something like that. Well, Lee Daly is my name. Scott Stevens is my erstwhile co-host.
Yeah, we're kind of on familiar terrain today, aren't we, Waleed? I mean, it feels like we've been here so many times before. Here we are, the aftermath of the High Court's decision last week ruling on the constitutionality of offshore detention. Here we are once again, protests, people coming out, really expressing kind of heartfelt pleas on behalf of these 267 asylum seekers now facing deportation back to Nauru. Here we are once again with the Prime Minister saying that if we yield one inch, if we leave the smallest crack in our border protection policy, it's going to send exactly the wrong message to people smugglers.
They are very dangerous and agile criminals. We have to be very careful. Anything we do which gives them a marketing opportunity, they will use, and they will use it to get more vulnerable people on boats and more children, and their parents will die by drowning at sea. We have stopped the boats and we are managing the caseload that we inherited from the Labor Party, but we have to do so, yes, with compassion, yes, yes, with a passionate concern for those children. We are giving their parents every incentive to return to their country of origin, to go to settle in another country, because we know that if we give those people, smugglers, any marketing opportunity, they will use it and there will be more deaths at sea, more children put at risk.
It's the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. Interesting way he's phrased this. I think, I should flag, we're not just talking about asylum seekers today. There's also a weirdly resurgent torture debate in the United States that I think is part of this same story that we're going to try to talk about today. But let's just focus on what Malcolm Turnbull said there. It seemed actually incoherent to me. Sort of lying beneath the silver tongue delivery, it was incoherent. We're going to do this with a passionate concern for these people. And in that concern, apparently, we are urging them and giving them every opportunity to return to the countries from which they've fled because we want to stop other people getting on boats. I think when you join all of those dots, you can't actually join them because they exist in different dimensions. This is the point that I want to try to get to today. In trying to argue that toughness is compassion, we have adopted, and I've flagged this before on previous shows, Scott, we have adopted a deeply utilitarian logic, I would argue, which is to say it is moral and compassionate of us to harm certain people or witness passively their destruction at our hands because there is a greater good that's being served in the saving of the lives of many more people. I'm not saying that's a completely unsustainable moral argument. It belongs within a moral tradition. You can believe that if you want. But what I am saying is that is a tradition that exists completely at odds with one that says that each human being is sacred and inviolable and you cannot occasion harm upon one in order to save another. That is, effectively, the liberal tradition. Now, what I find intriguing about that irreconcilability, Scott, is that we, as a society, have long ago, as a matter of our public moral reasoning, such as it exists, come down on the side of liberal democracy and liberal moral thought. That is to say, our system of government, our political culture, is set up on the assumption that you can't simply sacrifice or liquidate certain people in order to serve some other greater good. You can't simply put all your eggs in the basket of the greatest good for the greatest number. There is something sacred and inviolable about the human being. And yet, in this particular case, as is the case with the arguments that always surround torture, I would argue, that's coming out of the US, and even to the extent we've flirted with those arguments here, it's the same logic. These are the only cases, it seems to me, where we suddenly shelve our liberalism that we trumpet so loudly as being so definitive of us. We shelve it and we adopt this utilitarian ethic. And we do it so effortlessly, Scott. And I think it's the effortlessness of it that I want to talk about because it raises the question for me, what is it about our age, or perhaps it's ever been thus, but what is it about our age that allows liberal democracies to put aside all of their notions of liberalism and human rights in selected cases so easily without even having to articulate a coherent, well-worked-out justification for the dramatic philosophical shift. So I'm not just here wanting to say torture is bad or asylum seeker policies are bad. I'm wanting to interrogate why it is that the philosophical assumptions can change so easily and so invisibly, and whether or not that means that we actually even care about or believe in the liberalism that we apparently have founded our entire political culture on. All right, go.
Well, Lee, this is one of the few programs where I feel like, folks, just turn my microphone off. You can just go to the to the end of the program. I'm perfectly happy for you to keep going. Look, Waleed, you've got no argument from me. I mean, I suppose the only real inflection that I'd want to bring to this is that, you know, part and parcel of the notion of liberal democracy, and I mean, it is a textured tradition. I don't think liberalism is a single thing. I don't think democratic politics is a single thing. But one of the crucial ideas at the heart of it is that the ends do not justify the means. There has to be something about the way in which we pursue certain goals that either corrupts or ennobles those goals. In other words, yes, you can't simply do whatever the hell you want in order to get to a particular point. There's a name for that, and that's usually totalitarianism.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the fundamental ideas behind sort of various forms of totalitarian and other forms of ethnic cleansing. But I think for me, one of the ideas that is at the heart of liberalism is, like you said, the inviolability of the individual. In other words, it's individual self-determination, the security of the body of the citizen that is crucial. Now, I'm being very careful the way that I say that, because the original idea of liberalism is it's the body of the citizen. The purpose of the state, if you like, is to institutionalize the social, to institutionalize the home within which that body best connects to other bodies, within which it can thrive and prosper, within which it can pursue its freedoms. But it creates a kind of environment within which that freedom itself is interrogated. In other words, I can't prosper if those around me are immiserated. So, I mean, already within liberalism, you see this to some extent in Adam Smith. You certainly see this in Jean-Jacques Rousseau. You certainly see this in certain forms of, say, democratic tradition, you know, culminating in Hannah Arendt, that there is something about the inviolability of the person as a member of a political community that
and you're
is
saying
crucial.
That that's interesting in the case of asylum seekers or torture, because we are often talking about people who we have excluded from the political community. They're not part of it, and therefore we give ourselves a liberal out.
Yeah. Look, to some extent, I think what I'm trying to suggest is that liberalism itself underwent a certain transformation in the late 70s, where nation states are viewed maybe with a little bit more moral suspicion. I mean, we're thinking about the aftermath of Vietnam. We're thinking about the aftermath of the decolonization efforts. Nation states themselves are not necessarily inviolable or even moral institutions. And so once that happens, you know, the kind of concern for humanity as such, humanity or individual humans as an endangered species. It's very interesting, just by the way, Willie, to bring up Hannah Arendt one more time. I mean, one of her great criticisms of the early human rights movement of the late 50s, early 60s, is that it treated humans as if they were endangered animals, rather than humans as members of political communities. In other words, what I want to suggest to you is that one of the reasons that our liberalism is so inconsistent is because we no longer have a clear foundation for the idea of human rights themselves. We invoke human rights because, dear God, what would happen if we lost them? Human rights, to date, have been the most effective way, this is the way the story goes, to prevent certain perfidious wrongs. But there's no clear, and even you, Waleed, you use the term then, you know, sacred, there's a kind of sanctity to human beings. Well, on what basis? I mean, as soon as you cut away certain moral, theological, philosophical foundations, there's no basis for that. So I think there's something that's even happened to the human rights tradition itself that has rendered it without the protection of the state, without the idea of political communities of belonging, that they can then sort of reach in concentric circles and welcome other people in. I think there's something already there that makes the whole discourse of human rights and therefore the whole politics of liberalism very, very unstable.
So we've collapsed back on a liberalism that is confined only to the citizen.
I think that was the internal logic of liberalism always. Liberalism tried to become cosmopolitan. Much of our discourse remains cosmopolitan. But again, I really want to ask you, Waleed. I mean, I think your leanings are a bit more cosmopolitan than mine. But cosmopolitan on what basis? I mean, on what basis do we accord equal dignity to all people?
It depends who you're asking. If you're asking Kant, it's a different answer to if you're asking Beck, right? But, you know, I think I'm going to sidestep the cosmopolitan argument because I think that gets complicated for the reason that I think there's an argument for cosmopolitanism, which is the argument that Beck mounts, that it's something we should observe on the basis of necessity, that the world has become cosmopolitan without us necessarily intending it to be so, and so we actually need to evolve a cosmopolitan politics in order just to match reality, not as some aspirational thing. And that sort of banal cosmopolitan idea, I think, takes us in a different sort of a direction. But I think the fact that what you've put on the weakness of human rights discourse, the lack of philosophical underpinnings of it in our political culture, in the moral strictures that we observe or don't observe, I take that point. I do take that point. But we do nonetheless invoke human rights quite a lot as a political crutch,
that's right.
if nothing else, right? I suppose what we're learning is
but
that we
domestic,
don't really...
It's domestic human rights. It's human rights for me and my fellow citizens.
Oh, no. It's even foreign if it helps us on a foreign policy adventure.
Yes, agreed.
Right? So they've become political instruments, human rights, and I kind of grasp that. But I think the way to illustrate this, or maybe the cases we're discussing of asylum seeker policies which are deeply illiberal, or torture politics in the US, which we'll get to in a moment in more detail, I think... those examples perhaps demonstrate the weakness of the foundations that we're talking about so well. Because I would argue no political or moral value actually means very much until it's difficult to apply them.
Yes.
Right? So the idea that torture is a bad thing and we do not torture has no meaning in the absence of a reason to torture. It's only when we are tempted to do it that the idea that we do not do it actually has any significance or substance at all. And yet, in these cases, and you could probably enumerate many more, invariably, it seems, liberal democracies are foregoing those elements, which then raises the question, well, what do those liberal foundations, what do those liberal values actually mean? Does liberal democracy have any meaning at all, really, beyond the rhetorical? Or does it only exist when it's easy? I think that should be a foundation-shaking question.
Absolutely.
For those of us who live in liberal democracies, but I don't think it's one that we ask very much in this context because it's a bit highfalutin and abstract. But nonetheless, I think it's an important one.
Yeah, but anyway. But also, Waleed, I don't think it's necessarily a modern or an overly recent problem either. I mean, one of the issues of liberal democracies for the last 40 years is that politicians have bounced far too superficially, if you like, on daily events and then justified it to the population by necessity. In other words, we've lost the whole substructure of political principles.
Right. So our politicians should come out and say, we believe in the veneer of a liberal democracy, and then move on. You are listening to The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website, search for RN The Minefield. You can also tweet us at RN The Minefield. This week we are discussing dispensable human rights, I suppose, dispensable liberalism. Even waterboarding, or worse, explicitly, it seems, could be back on the agenda in the United States. You might have heard the Republican presidential debate in New Hampshire, prior to the primary, of course, which Donald Trump won. Ted Cruz was asked whether waterboarding was a form of torture. He said this.
Under the law, torture is excruciating pain that is equivalent to losing organs and systems. So under the definition of torture, it is not. It is enhanced interrogation. It is vigorous interrogation, but it does not meet the generally recognized definition of torture.
If elected president, would you bring it back?
I would not bring it back in any sort of widespread use, but the commander-in-chief has inherent constitutional authority to keep this country safe. And so if it were necessary to, say, prevent a city from facing an imminent terrorist attack, you can rest assured that as commander-in-chief, I would use whatever enhanced interrogation methods we could to keep this country safe.
Senator Cruz, thank you. Mr. Trump, you said not only does it work, but that you'd bring it back.
Well, I'll tell you what. In the Middle East, we have people chopping the heads off Christians. Not since medieval times have people seen what's going on. I would bring back waterboarding, and I'd bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding.
Mr. Trump, thank you.
Where do you begin? I mean, you know, firstly, okay, that's not the international definition of torture. But secondly...
No, it's the Bybee memo, which was a highly idiosyncratic definition of torture.
Oh, heavens above. But secondly, that was, yes, folks, you heard it right, that was Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump promising to reintroduce torture into America's arsenal of national security measures to the sound of applause. Where do you begin? Anyway, admittedly, America's own relationship to human rights is historically a bit of an ambiguous one. Now, someone who's chronicled the ambiguities of that relationship better than anybody else that I can think of is Barbara Keyes. Barbara is Associate Professor of History at the University of Melbourne School of Historical and Philosophical Studies. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, Scott.
Now, you know, you're a keen, no doubt, observer, aficionado of the American presidential primary. Are you surprised that even torture is back on the table during these debates?
I'm not. I admit that when I heard the Trump clip, I was taken aback. But then I thought, really, why should I be? Because, in fact, ever since 9/11, the willingness to torture America's enemies or to torture America's suspected enemies has been a litmus test of whether you're willing to do what is necessary to defend the country. And if you're not, then you're coddling terrorists. Former Vice President Dick Cheney's been the most vocal proponent of torture, you know, defending the Bush administration's use of torture and really open use of torture. But it's been a constant in American political discourse that we need to do, we meaning Americans, need to do whatever it takes to fight terrorism. Trump's not pushing any boundaries with that.
Is this new?
It goes back a long time. The CIA has been engaging in torture for many decades. If you are interested in tracing the long history, there's a great book by someone whose name is unfortunately escaping my mind right now, but traces a very long history of CIA and torture, and CIA spreading techniques to other countries so that they can torture their people too.
But not as an openly celebrated political tool.
No, it was hidden, and it really became an openly celebrated tool, as you put it, under Bush.
Okay, but hang on. There is a bit of a contradiction here already. I mean, one of the things that, Waleed, you and I have talked about a number of times on this show is that certainly the post-9/11 foreign policy has been something like, beneath their skin, everyone is American. Beneath the veneer of cultural difference, everyone is a secret Democrat. And you just need to topple this or that dictator, and the inner American in them will come to the surface. I mean, that was in many ways the guiding premise of the second invasion of Iraq. And yet at the same time, the very idea of torturing one's enemies is predicated on the idea that they are subhuman, that they are sub-Americans, if I can put it that way. I mean, there are two kind of competing, if you like, goals or outlooks of foreign policy there, aren't there?
Well, I think there's a disconnect there, because I think there is a sense in which Americans think of terrorists as a threat to their civilization, and you would do anything to eliminate that threat. So they can be eliminated. It's not them. They're not the people who are, you know, Americans if only they could see the way to be Americans.
Okay.
But what's interesting to me about the whole debate about torture now is we think of torture as a very deeply ingrained part of human rights, the human rights lexicon. It's been a sort of cause célèbre for human rights activists for a long time. We think of it as a very important, solid human rights norm. And we get very upset about torture when it happens in places like Syria. But I think if we look back, and if I can do my historian thing for a minute, if we look back at when the torture norm first began to be established in the 60s, I think we can see some of the dilemmas that we've been grappling with ever since then, and why it is that even after, you know, 50 years of trying to fight torture, trying to end torture, we really have not inched the needle downward in really any significant respect. And so I wanted to tell two stories about the early years of fighting torture. Very briefly, Peter Benenson was the very charismatic barrister who started Amnesty International in 1961. Amnesty International became the leading organization fighting torture. But originally, it was only about political prisoners. It had a very narrow mandate, and it was about writing letters and trying to get media attention to help the political prisoners. But they very quickly found that the media got tired of political prisoners. One political prisoner was much like the next. And searching away for a way to get media attention, they came on torture, because many of these political prisoners, of course, were tortured. And so Amnesty then sort of took torture by the bit and used it to sensationalize the issue of political prisoners, use it to great effect, building special campaigns that enormously expanded its prestige, its membership, its influence, and helped it win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977. But there are two things that Benenson said in those days about torture that I think are really interesting and illuminating. One is he said, first, if you want to get a story across, you want to get a young, attractive female prisoner tortured. Which I think is just that wording of get a prisoner tortured is revealing. But it speaks to the selectivity of the human rights program. And of course, human rights organizations cannot publicize every human rights abuse. They must be selective. But they've been selective in a very particular way. And they've emphasized cases of young, attractive people who remind us of ourselves.
Yeah.
Often, you know, especially in the early decades, the emphasis was on Christians, middle-class people being tortured.
Well, in the way that Trump's emphasis was on the beheading of Christians.
And exactly.
It's not only Christians who've been beheaded.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's this selectivity. And the whole issue of should we torture terrorists really hasn't come up, even though a lot of the early amnesty campaigns were, in fact, about people who were terrorists in their particular countries. Amnesty portrayed them as innocent. So we care about the torture of innocents. We don't really necessarily care about torturing terrorists. The second thing that Benenson said, and I think this really speaks to these ongoing debates about what is torture. It's so fundamental, right? What is torture? How do we define it? Benenson said, I'm just going to paraphrase, he said it's worse suffering for a sensitive person to be locked up without writing materials than it is for a taxi driver to have his balls pricked.
Wow.
Now, that's a stunning statement from the guy who founded Amnesty International. And I think it sets up this sort of hierarchy of victims. It even, to a degree, I think, legitimizes the physical torture of some people who aren't sensitive or aren't intellectuals. So we have this regime, this international law regime that says that all torture is impermissible. The UN Convention on Torture bans it, absolutely. But that's not how we think about it. We even Peter Benenson thinks it's okay to torture some people at some times.
So are you saying, or what is what flows from that, that the liberal foundations of human rights were undermined from the very beginning, and that that is the reason that avowedly liberal polities seem to feel no compulsion in adhering to their own creed?
I think so. I think an absolute ban on torture is never what anybody genuinely believed, and it's certainly not how it got practiced.
Hang on, Barbara. Does that mean, though, that absolute equality of human beings or the equal human dignity of human beings, are you suggesting then that that's also not what anybody actually really believed?
Well, I think people had beliefs, right? And beliefs didn't necessarily mesh with actions.
So we could say that people were equal?
But I think there's been a hierarchy embedded in the Human Rights Project from the beginning, because it's been a project of the West directed toward the rest. It's been about other people and other places for the most part. It's foreign policy. And it's not a coincidence that human rights in the West coincided with the end of imperialism, and that human rights provides a way for the West to assert its continuing moral support superiority and to intervene in the affairs of largely third world countries. And the language of human rights, you've talked about how capacious it is, and it can be subverted very readily as camouflage for very self-interested projects of greed, exploitation, will invade your country to protect your human rights.
Yeah, that was my reaction too, Scott.
and the rabbit hole just opened up under us.
It did, with a minute left to spare. So, I suppose this is a yes or no question. Are we talking about polities with no philosophical foundation ultimately? Like when it gets tough?
I wouldn't go that far. And
oh, thank God.
Maybe I'll just wrap it up with a sort of a word of caution from Hannah Arendt. That pity, taken as the spring of virtue, has proved to possess a greater capacity for cruelty than cruelty itself.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I thought I couldn't get more depressed about it, but I think I just did. Barbara, it's been illuminating and challenging in all sorts of awesome ways. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Barbara Keyes, Associate Professor of History at the University of Melbourne School of Historical and Philosophical Studies. Get a face full of that, Scott.
Oh, wow. Well, you can leave us a comment at RN The Mindfield. You can also follow us on Twitter. This is bound to provoke lots of conversation. We'd love to have that conversation with you.
We would indeed. And we will have that conversation with you in another format on another issue next week. So we hope that you can join us then. In the meantime, have a great one. Bye.
On the Norwegian island of Spitsbergen, they built a vast concrete bunker, a huge seed vault buried deep into the permafrost. It's designed to help protect the genetic diversity of our plants and crops. But it's not all cataclysmic paranoia. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault, part of our look at plants and preservation on Future Tense. And you can download the program from the RN website, find us via the ABC Radio app, or look for us on iTunes.